So I wanted to ask you, I mean, you're talking about encouraging everybody to tell the government to close Guantanamo. What would it take legally and structurally to close Guantanamo and to prevent future Guantanamos?
Good question. Well, there's 90 people that have been cleared of everything. So the first thing that should happen is those people should be sent back to their home countries if they won't be tortured. And that's the first thing that ought to happen. But that hasn't happened yet.
Why would they be tortured?
Well, the Chinese, if they went to Western China, they would be tortured. We have on the back of the flyer, there's an Algerian citizen who would be tortured if he was sent back to Algeria. So those 90 have to be sent back. As to the others, they have to be either charged or tried. Charged and tried or released. If you're not going to charge and try them, then they ought to be released. So there has to be no preventive detention at Guantanamo. You have to charge people with a crime and try them. And then, if you're convicted, then you go to jail. If you're not convicted, then you're released. But unfortunately, the Obama administration says even if we try you and you're acquitted, we have a right to hold you as a as an enemy combatant or belligerent or whatever term they want to use. So what it would take is really a couple of things would, could just happen within the administration without changes in law. The 90 could be sent back, homes could be found for them. The others could be charged and tried, and then if they're convicted, they go to jail, and if they're not, then they get released. But that's not the way it is right now. Now, we do have a problem with the law in the United States, that we can't bring Guantanamo detainees into the United States because Congress has passed a law, which Obama really never did anything about, and Democrats went along with it. And so now we have a situation when we go to Europe to beg them to take some of our Guantanamo detainees, and we have a whole team at the center that does that, that visits capitals, that does all that. Will you take our person? They say, well, the United States won't take one person. You guys created Guantanamo. How come you want us to take them? And, you know, we don't even know the names of the, there's actually 89 people who are cleared, released. We don't know the names of them. We represent some of them, so some of those we can do, go to Europe with, but others we don't even know the names. So one demand would be to just get the names of the 89 cleared people. It's all on our flyer, but that would be very important. The second thing would be, you know, the writ of habeas corpus, which I talk about, and it's this Latin term and all. As I said, it's the critical right that differentiates, to my view, a country from a democracy from a police state. Because in a police state, the executive picks you up and tosses you in a prison, and you're never heard from again. You can't go to court, and that's the end. So it's the underpinning of in law of what it means to be have a level of freedom. And here you have habeas. We won this right of habeas corpus, and we win the cases, and then the inmate or the person at Guantanamo, all they can do is like hang the sign over their bed. I won the right to be free. But the president won't let me be free. And it seems to me to be a tremendous interference with the judge's power to release people who the state is wrongfully holding. And so one thing the state could do, or Obama could do in this case, is say, I'm going to let the courts decide these cases as they should be decided. And what good is it to decide habeas corpus if at the end of the road you're still in jail? I mean, so we spent all these years winning this right, and essentially many of our clients remain in prison.
Well, that leads me to another question, which is, what are the advantages and disadvantages of trying to achieve social change through the judicial system rather than through our elected officials? I mean, this is an example of a court making a decision, and then it's not allowed to be enforced. But there's other advantages.
Sir, I mean, in my experience of litigating over the years, I've come to believe there's certain issues that you will never get elected officials to go in the right direction on. I considered the right to abortion to be one of those issues. Closing the HIV camp, we had that camp under Bush, that was the Haitians at Guantanamo. Clinton promised to close it. When he took office, there was too much political heat for him to close it, and I remember when my co-counsel and I went to see the Justice Department, they said the idea that we're gonna bring a black Haitian HIV-positive immigrant into the United States is just a non-starter. We're never going to do it voluntarily. And in that case, we had to win the court case. So certain kinds of social issues, one that I thought we would never get lifted, the HIV exclusion for coming into the United States. It took 25 years. People told me, don't litigate it. We're going to win this in Congress. Our Congress, you know, only until finally this year, I think, in the last year, They changed the regulation, or the president did, on the HIV exclusion into the United States. So there's certain issues. Guantanamo would certainly be another one. If you try and get through Congress to bring one Guantanamo detainee in this country, it's never going to happen. We had an experience when the Democrats took control of the House before Obama was elected, where we thought we could restore the writ of habeas corpus through legislative action in the House. We had 75 of the top high-powered lawyers in the United States come to Washington with the center and to lobby Nancy Pelosi and the whole crowd. And we thought we would win. And then in the end, we got a call from Pelosi saying she won't give it to us, that they're going to lose too many congressmen they need on some other piece of legislation, and it's done for. So I feel that litigation is the only way to win certain kinds of, particularly certain kinds of issues in this country.
Talk about some of the landmark cases that the Center for Constitutional Rights has won that have really changed the way, changed the game, and also where you've lost, but also changed the game.
Yeah, I mean, one of our board members, Jules Lobel, he's a professor, and he's done a lot of the litigation with the center. And he wrote a book called Winning Without Victory. And it's about cases that lose and how those can still play an important role. And he looked at the women's suffrage cases as one set of cases. The slavery cases is another. Women's suffrage, Katie Stanton went into court 100 times, was jailed for doing it. And it was still very important to raise it in a social and political way to say to the government, we will continue to litigate this issue throughout and make a social issue out of that. And he looked at the cases, some of the cases the center did, particularly the cases on Central America and U.S. intervention in the 80s when Jules and I together brought a dozen cases to try and keep the U.S. out of Central America. And we came close to winning a couple, but we essentially lost every one. But they were still very important statements politically that could be made around the illegality of what the U.S. was doing. So we don't, and Guantanamo would have been another. When we took the first Guantanamo cases, we had a team of some law professors who were advising us, and no one thought we had any chance of winning at all. Zero. Even I thought, this is like bringing, you know, the Japanese concentration camps during the Second World War, in the middle of the war. We're never going to win this case. It's not going to happen. There was a precedent called Eisentrager, dead set against us. No way. And we said, on the other hand, we have people in Guantanamo, incommunicado detention, not knowing what's happening to them, no writ of habeas corpus. We're going to fight for the writ. We've got to bring the case. We've got to bring public attention to it. This is just fundamental to our liberty. And so we brought it, even in the face of thinking total loss. Cases that, the second part of your question, cases that have won, I mean, if you were to, I'll give you a loss that was the most fatal loss we ever had, which was fought by a lawyer of ours, Rhonda Copeland, who died about a year ago. She was an incredible litigator, started at the center with me. And we were the first organization to really look at abortion as a woman's right and not a doctor's right. Abortion cases were litigated up until the McRae case as the doctor's right to give medical care. And the center, the women at the center and some others decided this should be a woman's right to choose. And Rhonda was one of the people involved in that. And the case she lost in the Supreme Court 5-4 is called the McRae case. If you've heard of the Hyde Amendment is the amendment when Hyde was a senator that prohibited states from using any federal funds so that poor women could get abortions. And many states were giving money for that. And we went to the Supreme Court and we lost it in 1981, 5-4. And we're still seeing the results of the Hyde Amendment today as we see these restriction after restriction. Now, Rhonda and a man named Peter Weiss also won one of the most important cases the center ever won that same day that we lost the McRae case in the Supreme Court. And the case is called Falartica v. Peña Irala. Imagine this situation. You're in Paraguay, and your son is tortured to death by a Stroessner police official. Stroessner was the dictator of Paraguay in the 70s. He's tortured to death. And then the torturer, your Paraguayan citizens, your torturer leaves and comes to the United States, and he's here in the United States, And he's a torturer. And you, as the parents of the kid, come to the United States, and there's your son's killer and torturer sitting there. Should there be a right to sue him for a torture that took place all the way in Paraguay, had no relationship to the United States, no U.S. citizen, nothing? And what we went to court on was used a 200-year-old statute and said, and that's where a famous quote is from, but we argue that torture was an international crime and a torturer could be brought to justice anywhere. And the decision ends with this ringing statement in Latin, but that says, a torturer is an enemy of all humankind, and can be brought to justice wherever. And from that case has blossomed not just 100, 200, 300. When you talked about the case against UNICAL for using slave labor in Burma, when we talked about, you know, the case against Shell for in Nigeria, for killing and drilling in Nigeria, those cases are all against corporations that have a presence in the United States and were doing torture overseas. And the case, they all come out of that one case. All of these major human rights cases against corporations, against bad guys, against the set of them. We brought suits against the former Haitian dictators on those cases. So it's a wide, that would be probably, you know, one of the more unique ones. The cases that started the center came out of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, a case called, there were the people from the Highlander Folk School, Dombrowski, the whole crowd that really was actively involved in the Southern Civil Rights Movement. And we won a major case in the Supreme Court that said that when the state governments go after civil rights people, we have a right to move those cases into federal court because they cannot get a fair trial in state courts. And that revolutionized justice in the South. And then a case that you can still see how you have to keep fighting it's called District Court. Arthur Kanoya argued it. It's the warrantless wiretapping case. It was the first case I worked on at the center in 71 or 2, maybe a little later. But it was during the war, Mitchell, the Attorney General, and Nixon said they had the right to warrantlessly wiretap anybody who was opposed to the war. It was a guy named John Sinclair out of Detroit. We find out about it because they try and prosecute him criminally. They have the wiretaps. And we argue that there was no right to warrantlessly wiretap an American citizen in the United States. And Arthur argued it in the court, and we won the absolute right to that you can't warrantlessly wiretap people, American citizens in the U.S. And of course, flash forward to the Bush administration, which then set up the entire program to warrantlessly wiretap. Believe me, everyone at my office, every Guantanamo attorney, probably half the people in this room. So more than half. So it's just, these things have to be constantly, constantly looked at and fought, and that's one lesson I learned from Rhonda. Rhonda used to come in the center in the 1980s and said, Michael, she said to the staff, the right to abortion that we won in McRae is being, you know, it's being depleted, it's being ended, it's being pushed at it. I said, Rhonda, what are you talking about? It's this. And of course, you know, she was right and I was not.
Well, what is the center doing now to fight the attacks against women's reproductive freedom?
Reproductive freedom is not what we're doing most on right now. We're doing gender issues. We just filed a big case in New Orleans against the enforcement of a criminal statute in New Orleans for crimes against nature. They were arresting gay people for committing crimes against nature. So our gender docket is growing more than our women's right to choose docket. What happened really since the center, when it started on that, there were no organizations doing abortion work on their own. Now there's, of course, the reproductive, there's the ACLU and there's the reproductive rights group out of, that split off the ACLU. So there's a lot going on. It's litigated in every state. It's not litigated by my office.
You were talking about this phenomenon that we have right now, which is unending wars. Now, budget-wise, we can't do that forever. I mean, we owe the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, if you add them up, equal pretty much the amount of money that we're in the hole to, you know, that we owe to China. And so there is an economic limit to this. Does that play a role?
Well, look where the economic limit is coming down on. coming down on austerity against the working class and lower taxes for the wealthy. I mean, that's how we're fighting those wars.
Right. But that cannot last forever.
I mean, if
forever.
Wisconsin keeps happening, maybe that'll have an effect. But as long as they can strip unions of bargaining rights, not have wealthy people pay higher taxes, and lower wages and keep lowering wages, you know, you're talking about putting the austerity of our wars and our debt on the backs of the poor. The only, and I'll do this facetiously, but the only silver cloud to spending all that money on wars, if people are familiar with Paul Kennedy's work, who says that empires fall, one way he thinks empires fall is they, to keep the empire together, they have to have such a huge war machine, which is not productive of anything, that eventually it drains them of productive capacity. You could argue that's happening in the United States. And so it may be that the wars, you'd never want to say this because obviously you don't want people killed in a war, but it could be a sign of the decline of the empire.
There, it's funny, when you were talking about the arc that bends toward justice, I mean, that's one of the narratives that we have in the United States. We have a good constitution, we have progress, we ended slavery, we got women's suffrage, all kinds of things like that. Then there's another narrative that says that we are an imperial power, we break all our treaties, we operate on the principle of might makes right. These are mythologies about ourselves that seem to be incompatible.
We have what we learn in school about our Constitution and the three branches and habeas corpus and all that, but that's what we learn in school. And of course, we don't even learn the real truth in school. Like when we were on the car trip out here, we came to an Indian trading post, and there's a huge mural of the Trail of Tears. So we don't learn that part of the history in school. But I would have to say, there's been a lot of upsurge and working class struggle in this country that is very important to talk about and recognize. But it's the Howard Zinn history of this country. It's not the history we learn in school. That part of the history I would embrace. The part of the history that went from the Indian Wars to Vietnam to Iraq is the elite history of the country, is the history that is the power history and is the one that destroys both our country and the world. And that's the history, unfortunately, we're living. But the history of revolt from under is the one that I would like people to be taught, because that does give you, the people of Madison, that was huge. That's not small what happened in Madison. And to see something like that in this country is really magnificent, is the only way I can think about it. Or to see what we had, which of course we always look to see what we had in the 60s and the 70s. And not to bring up my kids or any particular kids, but when I see young people and my children tell me about it, working whether it's in Appalachia on mountaintop removal with the people there, or working on the border in New Mexico, or working with groups all over this country that are actually doing something that is not necessarily recognized in the New York Times, but there's work and effort going on all over this country right now. And the question is when it will begin to come together in a form that will actually change things. But it's not a blank slate out there by any means. And as we all learn from our children, I learned that from my children.
I just want to say for our audience, there is a mountaintop removal issue that has just come up in New Mexico. A mining company from Colorado has staked several hundred claims to Otero Mesa, which is this wonderful wildlife region in New Mexico, and they want to do mountaintop removal to get minerals out of it. So keep your eye on that. Google Otero Mesa when you go home. There is, I think, how shall I say this? The level of political dialogue going on in the United States compared to Europe, it's really different. Why do the Europeans, to put it bluntly, why do they put up with us?
Well, they're not perfect by any means, the Europeans. They have plenty of problems. But I like to think that they had 400 years of war. I think two factors. They had 400 years of war where they destroyed most of the countries in Europe. And they're no longer a superpower. To a superpower, law is good for the other guy, but it's not good for you. It's like being a bully on the block. Why do I have to obey the law when I'm the bully on the block? I can scream about the torture going on in any country you pick, but not about the torture going back at home. I can bring Gaddafi to the International Criminal Court, which we won't even ratify or endorse. So Europe, I think, has learned something about, maybe it's learned something about war, and maybe because it's no longer a superpower, it actually believes that law might have to have some usefulness, and that people might want to obey them. But, you know, Europe was complicit in plenty of stuff. I mean, when we talk about rendition flights, the flights of picking up people and taking them to torture centers, those flights went through European airports. The Italian intelligence helped kidnap Abu Omar, an Egyptian cleric, from the streets of Milan. Then there was a very courageous, I didn't mention this in the talk, a very courageous magistrate who then went and indicted 26 CIA agents who cooperated in that kidnapping and arranged it, and they all got convicted and jailed, not jailed, jail sentences, but of course none of them are in Italy anymore. One of the station chief lost his house, which is at least some worth something.
And they're not going back to Italy.
Right, and they're not going back, believe me. Those guys. But the point, I think, is that Europe, at least on some level, talks and does better than we do in many ways. But underneath, it has an intelligence service that does plenty of bad stuff.
I often have conversations with people that go into some version of the following. If the reason we don't have the government we want, it's our own fault for not taking to the streets. You've talked about taking to the streets, the militarization of the police, bringing you to these little Guantanamos. I mean, there's so many stories, and Amy Goodman and other journalists being singled out and detained completely against their First Amendment rights to freedom of the press. And so taking to the street, it's not what it used to be. People don't want to put themselves in danger for very good reasons. What works now? What form of dissent do you think is most effective right now?
Well, I would still have to say that Wisconsin is the most effective means we've had of dissent that I've seen. I mean, it was actually something, I would still have to say that that's what works. I mean, one reason, which I'm sure many of us realize in the audience, that we don't have democracy in this country has to do with the fact that, you know, we have one person, one vote, we have all that, but then who controls, I mean, the media, unlimited campaign contributions. How do you function as a democratic country in that situation? It's very, very difficult for a democracy to function when it's so skewed economically and when the media and the campaigns and everything are really, really controlled by finance. I mean, you know, I remember when Obama was being elected, you know, there was all of a sudden a move of the investment bankers toward Obama during the election, and we were saying, well, is it because he's going to win, or is it because U.S. hegemonic interests, they want a softer glove. They don't want a metal glove of Bush anymore. Maybe they want velvet. And so you saw all this money going toward Obama, and then you saw who he appointed as his financial people, you know, the same. So I think that democracy from a vote point of view here is very difficult, which is why I think you have to show, like people did in Wisconsin. I still think, you know, despite all the things that can happen to you in a demonstration, believe me, plenty of bad stuff happened to us in the 60s and 70s. Friends of mine wrote a book called The Bust Book about what to do when you're in demonstrations. There were things like sew up your pockets so they can't plant marijuana on you, you know, all kinds of things like that. I mean, so it was bad in the 60s and 70s. But there were hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, and it's hard to stop it. It's hard to stop it.
I have to ask you this. Why are progressive groups, as we talked about, the Quakers, the Catholic workers group and so on, so much more the subject of domestic terrorism investigations than, say, right-wing groups that have a lot more guns and they say out loud how much they hate government?
I can only answer it from the structure of our government, but I can tell you why the Quakers and pacifist groups and other groups engaging the people we work with, witness against torture, Catholic workers, are very subject to government intrusion and surveillance. And that's because in the Patriot Act, which I failed to mention, but was, of course, repassed this week in some of its worst aspects. And, you know, this is always such garbage when you hear it from Congress, because when they passed the Patriot Act initially, they put in what we lawyers call sunset provisions. That means that after 4 years, the really nasty pieces of it are supposed to sunset, like the sun goes down, and they'll be gone. And then I always said I said sunset provisions, they never sunset, just like, you know, the sun never sets on the American Empire. They never sunset. So, of course, these provisions, which are the ones that allow the government to take all your business records, you know, the national security letters, all your credit card records, all your telephone records, all that stuff without actually getting a court subpoena, it didn't sunset. So it happened again. So in the Patriot Act initially, they put in a definition of domestic terrorism that came out of the WTO, the World Trade Organization demonstrations in 1999. And when we looked at it at the center, we said, this thing is terrible, because it had three elements. I'm not sure I'll remember them all, but one of them is you had to be against state or federal, had to be doing something against federal or state law, and it had to be something that was a threat to life, and it had to have a political goal. So I looked at the time I sat in front of the White House protesting the HIV camp in Guantanamo, and I was arrested. And if an ambulance wanted to get by on that street, it couldn't. It would have had to go around. And so technically, I was doing a protest for political reasons, endangering a life, and violating, in that case, a local law. So I would be committing under this new law an act of terrorism. So when you talk about going after these Quaker groups and those, they're doing it under that guise. And what was interesting about looking at them under terrorism labels is when the FBI did its own report, a good report, that said these shouldn't have been investigated under terrorism, but in fact there was nothing violative of the law in doing so, because the law is broad enough to cover investigating groups like the Quakers who engage in civil disobedience under terrorism.
Tell us about the next generation of civil rights lawyers, people who do what you do. Are there people going into that field?
You know, what's happened a little bit, I mean, yes, there are, and the answer is the center always has. Our last even legal worker job, and Vince can verify it, we had 400 people apply for the job of the Guantanamo legal worker job, which is essentially, legal, the non-lawyer. So there's a huge number of people interested in the work because they want something better to do than go into corporate law. One of the problems is, of course, they're not coming out of the political generation I came out of, you know, which is 1968, 69, 70, 71. They're coming out of a very different generation. And the other is, of course, that anybody who goes through law school is broke by the time they're out and has $140,000 or $200,000 in loans between college, undergraduate, and law school. And so there's a real lid in this country, this is where a real difference in Europe, a real lid on people and what professions they can choose unless they really are very strong, because they figure they can go in 5 years and pay their loans off in a big corporate firm. So that's a lid. But I would not say we have any issue about getting people. And at the center, and of course Vince can even describe it better than I can, the center is from a race, identity, complexion, whatever you want to call it, looks completely different than the institution that I walked into, you know, some 40 years ago when it was, you know, essentially white. It now includes people, you know, we have a tremendous number of people from the Middle East, South Asia, lawyers working who are from those places, Arabic speakers, Spanish speakers, you know, Latinos, blacks. It's just a different place reflecting really what this country proudly, in my view, has become.
So we're going to end now. You're going to sign books in the lobby, and don't forget to pick up the flyer that gives you a coupon to Hell No, which you should order. Everybody should read it. There's the second part of it is called What to Do If an Agent Knocks.
Very important. That's actually the most important part. The basic thing is talking to an FBI agent is like eating potato chips. Just remember that. Don't talk. Once you eat one potato chip, you keep talking.
All right. Thank you so much.